were pillars and a flight of steps. A moment later, I blinked and the images were gone. I opened my eyes to see him looking at me. It had all happened in a second. "I am aware of the act," Warden was saying. "Get to the point, Overseer. 40 is exhausted." The Overseer didn't balk at Warden's tone. He must be used to being despised. Instead, he offered me a smile, soft as oil. "I would like to invite 40 to perform with us on the day of the Bicentenary. I was impressed with her strength and agility on the night I captured her. It gives me great pleasure to invite her to be my principal performer, along with 1949-1 and 1949-8. I was about to refuse, in such a way as to earn myself a severe punishment, when Warden spoke. "As her keeper," he said, "I forbid it." I looked up at him. "She is not a performer, and unless she fails her tests before the Bicentenary, she remains in my keeping." Warden stared directly at the Overseer. 40 is a dreamwalker. The dreamwalker you were assigned to bring to this colony. I will not allow her to be paraded in front of the Saiyan emissaries like a common seer. That is an assignment for your humans, not mine." The Overseer wasn't smiling now. "Very good." He bowed, not looking at me. "Come, 12. Your challenge awaits." 12 slid me a look, one eyebrow raised in question. I nodded. He turned and followed the Overseer back to the rookery, walking with an easy stride. He didn't seem afraid of what he was about to face. Warden's eyes scorched on my face. "Do you know the Oracle?"
"No."
"He never took his eyes off you."
"Forgive me, Master," I said, "but am I not permitted to speak with other humans?"
He didn't take his eyes off me. I wondered whether the refs understood sarcasm. "Yes," he said. "You are permitted." He swept past me without another word. Chapter 11 Of Weeping. I didn't sleep well. My head hurt too much, a pain that throbbed at my left temple. I lay between the sheets and watched the candle burn to nothing. Warden had not sent me to my room at once. He'd offered me a little food and water, which I'd accepted out of sheer dehydration. Then he sat by the fire, gazing into the flames. It had taken me a good 10 minutes to ask if I could retire for the day, a question he'd answered with a curt affirmative. The upper floor was cold. The windows were like paper, and there was a leak. I wrapped myself in the thin sheets, shivering. After a while, I dozed off. Warden's words trembled in my ears, that my eyes held death and ice. 2012's images flashed up every few minutes, still imprinted on my dreamscape. I'd seen a few oracular images before. Nick had once shown me a snapshot of me falling off a low roof and breaking my ankle, which had happened the next week. I never questioned his weather predictions again. 2012 had summoned me to meet him at midnight. I saw no reason not to go. When I woke up, the clock was striking 11. I washed and dressed before I went down to Warden's chamber. It was silent. The curtains had been left open, admitting the light of the moon. For the first time in several days, I found one of his notes in the desk. "Find out what you can about the MM." A cold shiver ran under my skin. If I had to research the buzzers, that must mean I was destined to face them. It also meant I was free to see 12. In a way, I'd be following orders. 12 had just faced his second test. I wondered what he'd seen during the night so far. Finally, I'd have some solid facts about the MM, provided 12 hadn't been eaten, of course. Just before midnight, I made my way down the steps, closing the door behind me. Time to do my homework. I passed the night porter. She didn't greet me. When I requested more Numa, she handed them over, but she kept her nose turned up, still sore over the siren incident. It was cool outside, the air misted with rain. I walked to the rookery and picked up breakfast, skilly in a paper cup. In exchange, I parted with a few needles and rings. Once I'd forced myself to take a sip or two, I headed for the building the Harleys called the Hawksmoor, the great stone sentinel of the library and its courtyard. 12 was waiting behind one of the pillars, wearing a clean red tunic. There was a cut across his cheek. When he spotted my cup, he lifted an eyebrow. "You eat that?" I sipped from it.
"Why, what do you eat?"
"What my keeper gives me." "We're not all bone grubbers. Congratulations, by the way." He held out a hand and I shook it.
"David."
"Paige."
"Paige."
His dark eye itself fixed on my face. The other seemed less focused.
"If you haven't got anything better to do with your time, I thought I'd take you for a little walk."
"Like a dog?" He laughed without moving his lips.
"This way," he said. "If anyone asks, I'm bringing you in for questioning about one incident."
We walked together down a narrow street, towards the residence of the suzerain. David was about 2 inches taller than me, long in the arms and thick in the torso. He wasn't starving like the Harleys.
"Bit risky, isn't it?" I said.
"What?"
"Talking to me. You're a red jacket now."
He smiled.
"I didn't think you'd be easy meat. You're already fallen into their trap, aren't you?"
"What do you mean?"
"Segregation, 40. You see, I'm a red jacket, and you think I shouldn't talk to you. Did your keeper tell you that?"
"No, that's just how it is."
"There you have it. That's the whole point of this place, to brainwash us, to make us feel inferior. Why do you think they leave people in the tower for years on end?"
When I didn't reply, he shook his head.
"Come on, 40. Waterboarding, isolation, days without food. After that, even somewhere like this seems like a slice of heaven."
He had a point.
"You should hear the overseer. He thinks the rest should lead us. That they should be our new monarchy."
"Why would he think that?"
"Because he's indoctrinated."
"How long has he been here?"
"Only since Bone Season 19, from what I can gather. But he's loyal as a dog. He's been trying to root out good voyants from the syndicate."
"So he's a procurer?"
"He's not very good. Nashira wants a new one. Someone who can sense the ether on a higher level."
I was about to ask more when I stopped. Through the thin grey haze, I could see a circular building with a vast dome. It squatted in a deserted square, massive and cumbersome, opposite the residence of the suzerain. Dim amber light filtered through its windows.
"What is that?"
I looked up at it.
"The Harleys call it the room. Been trying to find out what it's for, but nobody seems to like talking about it. No humans allowed."
He walked ahead without even glancing at it. I jogged to catch up with him.
"You said he's been trying to get voyants from the syndicate?"
I prompted.
"Why?"
"Don't ask too many questions, 40.
I thought that was the point of this rendezvous."
"Maybe.
Or maybe I just like the look of you."
"Here's our stop."
Our destination was an ancient church. It must once have been magnificent, but now it was falling apart. The windows had no glass, the steeple was skeletal, and wooden slats blocked the south porch. I raised an eyebrow.
"Is this a good idea?"
"I've done it before. Besides," he ducked under a slat, "from what the overseer tells me, you're accustomed to unsafe structures." He looked over my shoulder.
"Quick, Grey Keeper."
I slid between the boards, just in time. Graphius passed by the entrance, leading 3 undernourished amorotics. I followed David through the church. A large portion of the ceiling had fallen into the chapel. Wooden beams and concrete had flattened the pews, and glass lay in fragments across the floor. I picked my way through the rubble.
"What happened here?"
David didn't answer the question.
124 stairs to the top," he said.
"Up for it." He was gone before I could answer. I followed him to the staircase. I was used to climbing. I'd climbed hundreds of buildings in one cohort. Most of the steps were still intact. It seemed like no time before we reached the top. A high wind caught my hair, whipping it back from my face. The scent of fire was strong and thick. David rested his arms in a stone balustrade. I like this place. He pulled a roll of white paper from his sleeve and used a match to light it. Higher ground. We stood on a balcony, right below the crumbling steeple. Part of the balustrade was missing, and another sign warned of the unstable structure. I looked up at the stars. You passed your second test, I said. If you want to talk, tell me about the MM. Eyes closed, he exhaled the smoke. His fingers were stained. What exactly do you want to know? What they are? No idea. You must have seen one. Not much. The woods are dark. I know it looked like a human, had a head and arms and legs in any case, but it moved like an animal. It also stank like a cesspit, and sounded like one. How can you sound like a cesspit? Like flies 40. Bzzz. Buzzer. What about its aura? I pressed. Did it have one? Not that I could see. It made the ether seem like it was collapsing, he said. Like there was a black hole around its dreamscape. This didn't sound like the sort of thing I wanted to face. I looked down at the city. Did you kill it? I tried. When he saw my face, he tapped his rule. They put a bunch of us in there, all pink jackets. Two groups. Two reds came with us, 30 and 25. They gave us all a knife each and told us to track the buzzer with whatever we could find. 30 said straight out that the knives were just there to make us feel better. The best way to track the thing was to use the ether. One of the pinks was a rhabdomancer, so we made some lots from twigs. 30 gave us a bottle of blood from some guy that got his hand bitten off. That way we could use him as a querent. We smeared the blood on the twigs, and the rhabdomancer cast them. They pointed west. We kept casting lots and changing direction. Of course, the buzzer was moving as well, so we didn't get anywhere. 21 suggested we bring it to us. We made a fire and did a seance, calling the spirits from the woods. Are there many? Yep. All the idiots that tried to escape through the minefield, according to the Reds. I suppressed a shiver. We sat there for a few minutes. The spirits vanished. We heard noises. Flies started coming out from the woods, crawling over my arms.
Then this thing came out of nowhere.
This giant bloated thing. 2 seconds later, it's got 19's hair in its mouth. Nearly takes her skin with it too, he added. She's screaming. The thing gets confused. It rips out some of her hair and goes after one. Carl? Don't know the names. Anyway, he squeals like a piglet and tries to stab it. Nothing happens. He examined the burning end of his roll. The fire was going out, but I could still see it. I tried using an image on it. A sort of white light and tried to stick it in the buzzer's dreamscape to blind it. Next thing I know, my head feels like it's been run over. And it's like there's been an oil spill in the ether. Everything's dark and dead. All the spirits in the area are trying to get away from the mess. 20 and 14 both run for it. 30 shouts after them that they're yellow jackets, but they're too scared to come back. 10 throws a knife and hits 5. He falls. The buzzer's on him in 2 seconds flat. The fire goes out. It's pitch black. 5 starts screaming for help. Everyone's blind now. I use the ether to work out where the thing is. 5's getting eaten. He's already dead. I grab the thing's neck and pull it off him. All this wet, dead skin's coming away in my hands. It turns on me. I can see these white eyes in the dark, just staring at me. Next thing I know, I'm flying through the air, bleeding like a stuck pig. He pulled down the neck of his tunic and peeled back a bandage. Below it were 4 deep gouges. The skin surrounding them was a milky bloodshot grey. They look like poltergeist wounds, I said. Wouldn't know. He secured the bandage over the wounds. I can't move. The thing's coming towards me, dripping blood on me. 10's been trying to help 5, but now he gets up. He's got a guardian angel, the only spirit that hasn't flown the coop. He throws it at the buzzer. I send another image into the dreamscape at the same time. It screams, really screams, starts crawling away, making this awful noise, dragging a chunk of fire with it. By this point, 21 has set fire to a branch. He throws it after the buzzer. I smell burning flesh. After that, I passed out, woke up an Oriole covered in bandages. And they gave you all red tunics. Not 20 and 14, they got yellow, and had to pick up what was left of 5. We stood in silence for a few minutes. All I could think of was 5, eaten alive in the woods. I didn't know his real name, but I hoped someone had said the Threnody. What a horrific way to go. I cast my gaze further afield. In the distance, I could make out a spot of light, little more than a candle flame from here. What is that?
Bonfire.
What for?
Buzzer corpses, or human corpses, depending who won.
He tossed away his roll.
I'm thinking they use the bones for some kind of augury.
Ash drifted past my eyes as he said it. I caught a flake on my finger. Augurs touch the ether through signs of the natural world, the body, wildlife, the elements. One of the lower orders in Jackson's eyes. Maybe the fire attracts them, I said. They did say this city was a beacon.
It's an ethereal beacon, 40. Lots of voyants and spirits and roughs together. Think about how the ether works.
How the hell do you know so much about it? I turned to face him. You're not from the Syndicate. So who are you?
A cipher, just like you.
I fell silent, grinding my lower jaw.
You've got more questions, he said after a brief silence. Sure you want to ask them?
Don't you start.
Start what?
Telling me what I want to know. I want answers. The words came fast and hot. I want to know everything about the place I'm supposed to be living in for the rest of my life. Can't you understand that?
Looking over the balustrade, we gazed down at the room. For fear that it might crumble under my touch, I tried not to put too much weight on the stone.
So, I said, can I ask those questions?
This isn't a parlor game, 40. I'm not here to play 20 questions. I brought you here to see if you really were a dreamwalker.
In the flesh, I said.
Not always from the sound of it. Sometimes you jump out of that flesh.
He looked me up and down.
They got you from the central cohort, from the inner sanctum of the Syndicate. You must have been careless.
Not careless. Unlucky. I stared him out. What's their concern with the Syndicate?
It's keeping all the good voyants for itself. It's hiding all the binders and dreamwalkers and oracles, all the highest orders, the ones Nashira wants in a colony.
That's their concern with the Syndicate, 40. That's why they're going to sign this new act.
What does it say?
Nashira's been struggling to get a hold of decent voyants. They're all protected by gangs. Until they figure out how to disband the Mime Lords in London, they have no choice but to expand to get better ones. The Act promises that Sheol too will be established within 2 years, with Cyan Paris as its harvest citadel.
He traced the wounds on his chest.
And who's going to stop them, with the Emim there to kill us if we try?
A strange, cold feeling came over me. Nashira considered the Syndicate a threat. That was news to me. I knew the Mime Lords as a band of backbiting, self-seeking egoists. At least that was what the central ones were like. The Unnatural Assembly hadn't met for years. The Mime Lords had been allowed to do as they liked in their own areas, seeing as Hector was too busy whoring and gambling to manage them. Yet far away in Sheol One, the Blood Sovereign of the Rephaim feared the lawless rabble.
You're one of her loyal followers now, I glanced at his red tunic.
Are you going to help them?
I'm not loyal, 40. That's just what I tell them.
He looked at me. Have you ever seen a ref bleed?
I didn't know what to say. Their blood is called ectoplasm. Took its ultimate obsession. Refs are something like the ether in flesh. Their blood is the ether liquefied. You see, ectoplasm, you see the ether. You drink it, you become the ether. Like them.
Wouldn't that mean Amarotics could use the ether? All they'd have to do is touch a bit of ectoplasm.
Right. For Rotties, in theory, ecto would act as a kind of substitute aura. Short term, of course. The side effects only last about 15 minutes. Still, if we did some science and smoothed out the rough edges, I'm willing to bet we could sell an instant clairvoyance pill within a few years.
He gazed out down at the city.
It'll happen one day, 40. We'll be the ones experimenting on these bastards, not the other way around.
The refs had been foolish to make this man a red jacket. It was clear that he despised them.
One more question, David said.
Fine. I paused, then thought of Liz. What do you know about Bone Season 18?
I wondered if you'd ask about that.
He moved another slat aside, exposing a broken window.
Come on, I'll show you.
I followed him through it.
There were spirits in this room. I wished I could see how many there were.
I guessed about 8 or 9. The air was mildewed, tinged with the sickly smell of dying flowers. A shrine had been assembled in the corner. A roughly cut oval of metal, surrounded by humble offerings, candle stubs, broken sticks of incense, a wilted sprig of thyme, labels with names. In the center of it all was a small bouquet of buttercups and lilies. It was the lilies that were giving off the smell. They were fresh. David pulled a torch out of his pocket.
Take a look at the ruins of hope.
I looked closer.
Words were scored onto the metal.
For the fallen. 28th of November, 2039. 2039, I said. Bone Season 18. 1 year before I was born. There was a rebellion that day, on November tide. David kept the torch on the shrine. A group of refs rose up against the Sargus. They got most of the humans on their side. Tried to kill Nashira and evacuate the humans to London.
Which refs?
No one knows.
What happened?
A human betrayed them. 1839-7. 1 week link in the foundation and the whole thing came crashing down. Nashira tortured the ref perpetrators. Scarred them. The humans were all slaughtered by the Emim. Rumour has it, there were only 2 survivors. Apart from Duckett. The traitor and the kid.
Kid?
Duckett told me everything. He was spared because he was too much of a yellow jacket to rebel. He begged on his knees for them to spare him. He told me there was a kid brought here that year, 4, maybe 5 years old. 1839-0.
Why the hell would they bring a child here?
I settled in my stomach.
Children can't fight buzzers.
No idea. He thinks they were trying to see if she'd survive.
Of course she wouldn't survive. A 4-year-old couldn't live in that slum.
Exactly. My inside started to twist. She died.
Duckett swears her body wasn't found.
He had to clear up the corpses, David said. Part of the exchange for his survival. He says he never found the little girl, but this says otherwise.
He shone his torch at one of the offerings. A filthy teddy bear with button eyes. Around its neck was a note. I held it up to David's light. 1839-0. No life lived is lost. Silence fell, broken by a distant chime. I laid the bear back among the flowers.
Who did all this? My voice hurt. Who made the shrine?
The Harleys. And the scarred ones. The mysterious refs that rose up against Nashira.
Are they still alive?
No one knows. But I'm willing to bet they're not. Why would Nashira let them walk around the city knowing they're traitors?
My fingers shook. I hid them under my sleeves. I've seen enough, I said.
David walked me back to Magdalen. It was still a few hours until dawn, but I didn't want to see anyone else. Not tonight.
When the tower was in sight, I turned to face David.
I don't know why you spoke to me, I said. But thank you. For what? Showing me the shrine.
You're welcome.
His face was cast in shadow.
I'll give you one more question, provided I can answer it in less than a minute.
I thought about it. I still had so many questions, but one had bothered me for a few days.
Why are they called bone seasons?
He smiled.
Don't know if you know, but bone used to mean good, or prosperous, from the French bon. You might still hear it in the streets. That's why they named it. The good season, the season of prospect. They see it as collecting their reward, the great condition of their bargain with Sion. Of course, the humans see it differently. To them, bone means just that. Bones, starvation, death. That's why they call us bone grubbers, because we help lead people to their deaths. By now my whole body was cold. Part of me had wanted to stay out here. Now I wanted to leave.
How do you know all this? I said. The refs can't have told you.
No more questions, I'm afraid. I've already said too much. You could be lying.
I'm not.
I could tell the refs about you. I stood my ground. I could tell them what you know.
Then you'd have to tell them what you know, too.
He smiled at me and I knew I'd lost. You can owe me a favor for that information, unless you want to pay me back now.
How?
My answer came when he touched my face. His hand pressed against my hip. I tensed.
Not that, I said.
Come on. His hand stroked up and down my waist, and his face came closer to mine.
You hock up your pill.
What? You want some sort of payment?
I pushed him away.
Go to hell, Red Jacket.
David never took his eyes off me.
Do me a favor, he said. Found this in Merton. See if you can make anything of it.
You're smarter than I thought.
He pressed something into my hand.
An envelope.
Sweet dreamin', 40.
He walked away.
I stood there for a moment stiff and cold, before I leaned against the wall. I shouldn't have gone to that place with him. I knew better than to walk with strangers in dark streets. Where were my instincts?
I'd learned too much in one night. Liz had never mentioned that refs, had been partially responsible for the uprising of Bone Season 18. Perhaps she didn't know.
The scarred ones. I should look for them. For the ones that had helped us. Or perhaps I should keep my head down and get on with my new life. That was safe. That was easy.
I wanted Nick. I wanted Jax. I wanted my old life back. Yes, I'd been a criminal, but I had also been among friends. I'd chosen to be with them. My position as a Molisher had protected me from people like David. Nobody had dared touch me in my own territory. But this wasn't my territory. Here I had no power. For the first time, I wanted the protection that lay inside the stone walls of Maudlin. I wanted the protection Warden's presence guaranteed, even if I hated it. I pocketed the paper and headed for the door. When I got back to the Founder's Tower, I expected to find an empty room. What I found was blood. Ref blood.
Chapter 12. A Fever. The room was in disarray. Glass shattered, instruments broken, a curtain half torn from its rail, and spots of glowing chartreuse on the flagstones, soaked into the fibers of the rug. I stepped over the glass. The candle on the desk had been snuffed out. So had the paraffin lamps. It was deathly cold. I could feel the ether everywhere. I kept my guard up, ready to sling my spirit at a potential attacker. The drapes were drawn around the bed. Another dreamscape was behind it. Ref, I thought. I stepped towards the bed. Once I was within reach of the drapes, I tried to think rationally about what I was about to do. I knew Warden was behind them, but I had no idea of what sort of state he would be in. He might be injured, sleeping,
dead. I wasn't sure I wanted to know which one it was. I steeled my nerves. My fingers flexed before they grasped the heavy fabric. I pulled the drape aside. He was slumped on the bed, still as a corpse. I climbed onto the covers and shook him. Warden? Nothing. I sat back on the bed. He had told me explicitly that I wasn't allowed to touch him, that I wasn't supposed to help him if this happened, but this time the damage looked much, much worse. His shirt was drenched. I tried to turn him over, but he was a dead weight. I was checking his breathing when his hand snatched out and caught my wrist. You. His voice was thick and raw. What are you doing in here? I was... Who saw you come in? I held very still. The night porter. Anyone else? No. Warden pushed his weight onto his elbow. His hand, still gloved, went straight to his shoulder. Since you are here, he said, you may as well stay and watch me die. You will enjoy that. He was shaking all over. I tried to think of something spiteful to say, but what came out was quite different. What happened to you? He didn't answer. Slowly I reached for his shirt. His grip on my wrist tightened. You need to air the wounds, I said. I am aware of that. So do it. Do not tell me what to do. I may be dying, but I am not subject to your orders. You are subject to mine. What are your orders? To let me die in peace. But the order lacked force. I shoved his gloved hand from his shoulder, revealing a mess of chewed flesh. Buzzer. His eyes flared up as if some volatile chemical had reacted inside them. For a moment I thought he would kill me. My spirit strained against my mind, bursting to attack. Then his fingers loosened around my wrist. I scanned his face. Get me water. His voice was barely audible. And salt. Look in the cabinet. I didn't have much choice but to do it. With his eyes on my back, I unlocked the curio cabinet and pulled open the doors. I took out a heartwood salt cellar, a golden bowl and a flagon of water, along with a stack of linen. Warden tore open the ties at the top of his shirt. His chest was slick with sweat. There is a pair of gloves in the drawer, he said, nodding to the writing table. Put them on. Why? Just do it. I clenched my jaw, but I did as he said. In the drawer, beside the gloves, its black-handled blade lay sheathed and clean. The sight of it gave me pause. I turned my back to him and pulled on the gloves. I wouldn't even leave a fingerprint. I used my thumb to push the blade from its sheath. I would not try it. The sound of his voice made me stop. Cold steel cannot kill or fate, he said softly. If you buried that blade in my heart, it would not stop beating. The silence thickened. I don't believe you, I said. I could gut you. You're too weak to run. If you wish to take the risk, then be my guest. But ask yourself this. Why do we allow red jackets to carry weapons? If your weapons could kill us, why would we be so foolish as to arm our prisoners? His eyes scalded my back. Many have tried. They are not here now. A cold tingling started along the back of my arm. I returned the knife to the drawer. I don't see why I should help you, I said. You weren't exactly grateful last time. I will forget that you are going to kill me. The grandfather clock ticked with my pulse. Finally, I looked over my shoulder. He looked back at me, the light ebbing from his eyes. I crossed the room slowly and placed the items on the nightstand. What did this? I said. You know. Warden pressed his back against the headboard, his jaw rigid. You did the research. Emite. Yes. The confirmation chilled my blood. Working in silence,
I mixed the salt and water in the bowl. Warden watched me. Once I'd soaked and wrung out a square of linen, I leaned across to his right shoulder. The sight and smell of the wound made me jerk back. "This is necrotic," I said. The wound had darkened to a rotten, oozing grey. His skin was hot as coal. I guessed his temperature was probably around twice what it should be in humans. So hot I could feel it through the gloves. The flesh around the bite was beginning to die. What I needed was an antipyretic. I didn't have any quinine, which is what Nick usually used to crank down our temperatures. It was easy to sneak out of oxygen bars. They used it for fluorescence. But I doubted I could find it here. Saline and good luck would have to do. I squeezed some water into the wound. The muscles in his arm hardened, and the tendons of his hand pushed out. "Sorry," I said. Then wished I hadn't. He wasn't sorry when he watched me get branded, or when Seb died. He wasn't sorry for anything. "Speak," he said. I looked at him. "What?" "I am in pain. Some idle distraction would be helpful." "Like you're interested in anything I say." The words came out before I could stop them. "I am," he said. He was pretty damn calm, considering his condition. "I am interested to know about the person with whom I share quarters. I know you are a murderer," I tensed, "but there must be more to you than that. If not, I have made a very poor choice in claiming you. I never asked you to claim me. Yet I did." I kept sluicing away at the wound, pressing a little too hard. I saw no reason to be gentle with him. "I was born in Ireland," I said, "in a town called Clonmel. My mother was English. She ran away from Sion." He nodded, barely. I continued. "I lived with my father and grandparents in the Golden Vale, in the southern dairy farming district. It was beautiful there. Not like Sion's citadels." I wrung out the linen, soaked it again. "But then Abel Mayfield got greedy. He wanted Dublin. That was when the Molly riots started. Mayfield's massacre." "Mayfield," Warden said, looking at the window. "Yes, I remember him. An unpleasant character." "You met him?" "I have met every Sion leader since 1859. "But that would make you at least 200 years old." "Yes." I tried not to falter in my work. "We thought we were safe," I said. "But in the end, the violence spread south. We had to leave." "What happened to your mother?" Warden kept his eyes on mine. "Was she left behind?" "She died. Placental abruption." I sat back. "Where's the next bite?" He pulled open his shirt. The wound ripped down his chest. I couldn't tell if it was teeth or claws or something else that had made it. His muscles locked when I dabbed water on the torn skin. "Continue," he said. So I wasn't such a boring human. "We moved to London when I was 8, I said. "Out of choice?" "No. My father was conscripted by Sysors that year." I took his silence to mean that he didn't know the shorthand. "Sion, Special Organization for Research and Science." "I know it. Why was he conscripted?" "He was a forensic pathologist. He used to do a lot of work for the Gardaí. Sion told him to find a scientific explanation for why people become clairvoyant and why spirits linger after death." I sounded bitter, even to my own ears. "He thinks it's an illness. He thinks it can be cured." "Then he cannot sense your clairvoyance." "He's amaurotic. How could he?" He didn't comment. "Did you have your gift from birth?" "Not fully. I could sense auras and spirits from when I was very small. Then I was touched by a poltergeist." I sat back to wipe my brow. "How long do you have left?" "I'm uncertain of that. Salt stays off the inevitable, but not for long." He was quite blasé about this. When did you develop your ability to dislocate your spirit? The talking was keeping me calm. I decided to be truthful, if only because he probably knew everything about me. Nishira had known I was from Ireland. They must have all sorts of records. He might be testing me, seeing if I'd lie to him. After the poltergeist touched me, I started having the same dream. At least, I thought it was a dream. I emptied some water over his shoulder. I dreamed of a field of flowers. The further I ran through the field, the darker it became. Every night I would go a little further. Until one day, I was at the very edge, and I jumped, and then I was falling. I set to work on the wound. I was falling into the ether, falling out of my body. I woke up in the ambulance. My father said I'd sleepwalked into the living room, then just stopped breathing. They said I must have fallen into a coma. But you survived.
Yes.
And I wasn't brain damaged. Brain hypoxia is a risk of my condition, I said. I didn't like telling him about myself, but I supposed it was better that he knew. If he forced me into the ether for too long without life support, my brain would end up damaged beyond repair. I was lucky. Warden watched as I cleaned his shoulder wound. That would suggest to me that you do not enter the ether very often, for safety, he said. But you seem familiar with it.
Instinct. I looked away from his eyes.
Your fever won't break without medicine. In a sense, I wasn't lying. My gift was instinctive. But I wasn't about to tell him that I'd been nurtured and trained by a mime lord who'd kept me wired on life support.
The poltergeist, he said.
Did it leave scars? I took off one glove and held out my left hand. He looked down at the marks. I let him. It was unusual for a developing voyant to be so violently exposed to the ether. I guess there was already a break in me, something that let the ether in, I said. The geist just flayed me open.
Is that how you see it? He said. The ether invading you.
How do you see it?
I make no comment on my own opinion, but many clairvoyants see themselves as invading the ether, not the other way around. They see it as disturbing the dead.
He didn't wait for an answer.
I have seen this happen before. Children are vulnerable to sudden changes in their clairvoyance. If they are exposed to the ether before the aura has properly developed, it can become unstable.
I pulled my hand back.
I'm not unstable.
Your gift is.
I couldn't argue. I'd already killed with my spirit. If that wasn't unstable, I didn't know what was.
There is a type of necrosis in my wounds, Warden stated. But it only affects Rephaim. The human body is able to fight it.
I waited for the point.
Rephite necrosis can be destroyed by human blood. Provided their bloodstream is not compromised, a human can survive a bite.
He indicated my wrist.
Around a pint of your blood would save my life.
My throat tightened.
You want to drink my blood?
Yes.
What are you, a vampire?
I would never have thought a Cyan Denison would have read about vampires.
I tensed.
Shoot. Only a high-up syndicate member would have access to literature that included vampires or any other supernatural creature. In my case, it was a Penny Dreadful, The Vamps of Vauxhall, written by an anonymous medium from Grub Street. He spun all sorts of stories to make up for the lack of interesting literature available from Cyan, using folk tales from the world beyond. His tales had such titles as Tea with a Tasser and The Fae Fiasco. The same writer had knocked out a few decent potboilers about voyance, like The Mysteries of Jacob's Island. Now I wished I'd never read them. Warden seemed to take my silence as a symptom of disquiet.
I am not a vampire, nor anything else you might have read about, he said.
I do not feed on flesh or blood. It gives me no pleasure to ask for it. But I am dying, and it so happens that your blood, on this occasion, given the nature of my wounds, can restore me. You don't look or sound like you're dying. Trust me, I am. I didn't want to know how they'd found out that human blood could combat this infection. I didn't even know if it was true. Why should I trust you? I said. Because I saved you the humiliation of having to perform in the Overseer's troop of fools, if you require one reason. What if I need two? I will owe you a favor. Any favor? Anything but your freedom. The word died on my lips. He'd anticipated my request. I should have known freedom was too much to ask, but a favor from him might be invaluable. I picked up a shard of glass from the floor, part of a vial, and I sliced across my wrist. When I offered it, he narrowed his eyes. Take it, I said, before I change my mind. Warden looked at me for a long time, assessing my face. Then he took my wrist and pulled it against his mouth. His tongue skimmed over the open wound. There was a slight pressure as his lips closed over it, as he squeezed my arm to force out blood. His throat throbbed as he drank. He settled into a steady cadence. There was no sudden bloodlust, no frenzy. He was treating this as a medical procedure, clinical, detached, nothing more or less. When he let go of my wrist, I sat back on the bed, too fast. Warden guided me to the pillows, slowly. He walked to the bathroom, strong again already. When he returned, he was carrying a glass of cold water. He slid an arm under my back and lifted me into a sitting position, holding me in the crook of his elbow. I drank. It had been sweetened. Does Nashira know about this? I said. His expression darkened. She may question you about my absences and my injuries, he said. So she doesn't know. No reply. He propped me up on some heavy velvet cushions, making sure my head was supported. The nausea was passing, but my wrist still dripped blood. Seeing it, Warden reached for the nightstand and procured a roll of gauze. My gauze. I recognized the band I'd secured it with. He must have taken it from my backpack. It made me cold to think of it in his hands. It reminded me of the missing pamphlet. Did he have it? He took my wrist. His massive gloved hands were gentle, covering the cut in sterile white. His way of thanking me, I supposed. Once the blood had stopped seeping through the gauze, he fixed the dressing with a pin and laid my arm across my chest. I kept my eyes on his face. It seems we are at stalemate, he said. You have a talent for finding me in delicate situations. I would expect you to take pleasure in my times of weakness, yet you give me your blood. You clean my wounds. What is your motive? I might need a favor, and I don't like to watch things die. I'm not like you. You judge too easily. You watched while she killed him. I should have been afraid to say these words. But I didn't give a damn. You watched. You must have known what she was going to do. Warden was unresponsive. I turned away from him. Perhaps I am a whited sepulchre, he started.
A what?
A hypocrite. I rather like the turn of phrase, he said. Perhaps you think me evil, but I do keep my word. Do you keep yours?
What are you getting at?
Tonight's events must never leave this room. I wish to know if you will keep them secret.
Why should I?
Because it would not help you to tell it.
It would get rid of you.
I thought his eyes changed.
Yes,
it would get rid of me, he said. But your life would not improve. If you were not thrown onto the streets, you might be given another keeper. And not all of them are as liberal as I am. By rights, I should have beaten you to death for some of the things you have said to me over the past few days. But I understand your value. Others will not. I opened my mouth to retort,
but the words fizzled out. It was true. I didn't want another keeper. Not if they were all like Thuban. So you want me to keep your secret? I rubbed my wrist. And in exchange? I will try to keep you safe. There are an infinite number of ways you could die here, and you do not help yourself avoid them. I have to die eventually. I know what Nishira wants with me. You can't protect me. Perhaps not, in the end, but I presume you would like to survive your tests. What's the point? You can prove to her how strong you are. You are no yellow jacket. You can learn to fight. I don't want to fight. Yes, you do. It is in your nature to fight. The clock in the corner chimed. Having a ref ally was wrong. At the same time, it would significantly increase my chances of survival. He could help me get supplies, help me survive. Maybe for long enough to escape this place. Fine, I said. I won't tell anyone, but you still owe me a favor. I held up my wrist. For the blood. Just as I said it, the doors burst open. A ref woman swept into the room. Pleione Swallowson. She looked first at the state of the room, then at me, and finally at Warden. Without a word, she tossed him a vacutainer. Warden caught it in one hand. I looked at it. Blood. Human blood. It was labeled with a small grey triangle, and a number. A-14. Amarotic 14. Seb. I looked at Warden. He inclined his head, like we'd shared a little secret. A visceral revulsion overwhelmed me. I stood up, still weak from blood loss, and lurched up the stairs to my prison. Chapter 13. His Picture. I first met Nick Nigord when I was 9 years old. When I saw him next, I was 16. It was the summer term of 2056, and at the 3-5 school for girls of quality, we year 11s had entered the most important period of our lives. We could stay at school for another 2 years, during which we would be doing university prep, or leave and find a job. In an effort to convert the undecided, the schoolmistress had organized a series of lectures from inspirational speakers, SVD agents, media raconteurs, even an Archon politician, the Minister of Migration. That day was geared towards medical science. All 200 of us were herded into the lecture hall, dressed in our black suits, red ribbons and white blouses. Miss Briskin, the chemistry mistress, stepped up to the lectern.
"Good morning, girls," she said. "Good to see you all so bright and early. Many of you have expressed an interest in scientific research as a career path. I hadn't. So this should be one of our most thought-provoking lectures." A smattering of applause. "Our speaker has already had a terribly exciting career." I wasn't convinced. "He transferred from the University of Science, Stockholm, in 2046, completed his studies in London, and now works for SciSource, the largest research facility in the Central Cohort. We are truly honoured to have him here today." There was a shiver of excitement from the front. "Please put your hands together and welcome our speaker, Dr. Nicholas Nigord."
My head snapped up. It was him. Nick. He hadn't changed a bit. He was exactly as I remembered him. Tall, soft-featured, handsome. Still young, though his eyes bore the burden of a hectic adult life. He wore a black suit and a red tie, like all Scion officials. His hair was smoothed back with pomade, a style popular in Stockholm. When he smiled, the prefect sat up straighter.
"Good morning, ladies."
"Good morning, Dr. Nigord.
Thank you for having me here today." He shuffled his papers with the same hands that had stitched my injured arm when I was 9. He looked right at me, and he smiled. Behind my ribs, my heart flickered. "I hope this talk is enlightening, but I won't take offense if you fall asleep." Laughter. Most officials weren't so jocular. I couldn't take my eyes off him.
7 years of wondering where he might be, and he'd walked into my school. A picture from my memory. He talked about his research into the causes of unnaturalness, and about his experiences as a student in 2 different science citadels. He made jokes and encouraged audience participation, asking questions as often as he answered them. He even had the schoolmistress smiling. When the bell rang, I was the first out of the lecture hall, heading for the corridor at the back of the lecture theatre. I had to find him. For 7 years I'd tried to understand what had happened in the poppy field. There had been no dog. He was the only one who could tell me what had left the cold scars on my hand. The only one who could give me answers. I headed down the corridor, buffeting past chattering year eights. There he was, outside the staff room, shaking the hand of the schoolmistress. When he saw me, his eyes brightened. "Hello," he said. "Dr. Niegord." I could hardly get the words out. "Your speech was very inspiring." "Thank you." He smiled again, and his eyes pierced mine. He knew. He remembered. "What's your name?" Yes, he knew. My palms tingled. "This is Paige Mahoney," the schoolmistress said, putting emphasis on my surname. My very Irish surname. She looked me up and down, taking in my loose bow and unbuttoned blazer. "You ought to get to class, Paige. Miss Anvil has been very disappointed with your attendance of late." Warmth rose to my cheeks. "I'm sure Miss Anvil can spare Paige for a few minutes." Nick gave her a winning smile. "I'd love to spend some time with her." "That's very kind of you, Dr. Niegord, but Paige has been with the nurse a great deal recently. She needs to attend all her classes." She turned to him, lowering her voice. "Irish girl. These brogues often make up their own minds as to how much work is necessary." My vision tunneled. A pressure pushed at the inside of my skull, as if it were about to explode. A trail of blood crept from the schoolmistress's nose. "You're bleeding, miss," I said. "What?" When she looked down, blood dripped onto her shirt. "Oh, now look what I've done." She covered her nose. "Don't just stand there gawking, Paige. Get me a handkerchief." My head gave a throb. A grey web pulled across my eyes, tightening my vision. Nick stared at me as he handed her a packet of tissues. "Perhaps you should sit down, schoolmistress." He placed a hand on her back. "I'll join you in a moment." As soon as the schoolmistress was gone, Nick turned to face me. "Do people often have nosebleeds around you?" His voice was quiet. After a moment, I nodded. "Have they noticed? I've never been called unnatural yet." I sought his gaze. "Do you know why it happens?" He glanced over his shoulder. "I might," he said. "Tell me, please." "Dr. Niegord." Miss Briskin put her head around the staff room door. "The governess would like to speak to you." "On my way." As soon as she was gone, Nick said against my ear, "I'll come back in a few days. Do not sign up for the university, Paige. Not yet. Trust me." He squeezed my hand. Then, just as quickly as he'd come, he was gone. I was left to cradle my books to my pounding heart, my cheeks hot and my hands clammy. A day hadn't gone by when I hadn't thought of Nick, and now he had returned. I gathered my composure and walked to my class, still struggling to see or think. He'd remembered my name. He knew I was that little girl he'd saved. I didn't think he'd come back. I couldn't be that important to him. Not now he'd made his fortune in the world. But 2 days later, he was waiting for me outside the school gates. Something strange had happened that morning. I daydreamed about a silver car. The picture had come to me during French, leaving me nauseated. Now the same car was outside, and Nick was in the driver's seat, wearing sunglasses. I sleepwalked to the window, away from the other girls. He leaned out of it. "Paige?" "I didn't think you'd come back," I said.
Because of the nosebleed?
Yes.
That's why I'm here. He pushed his shades to the end of his nose so I could see his tired eyes. If you want to know more, I can tell you, but it can't be here. Will you come with me?
I glanced over my shoulder. None of the students were paying attention.
All right, I said. Thank you.
Nick took me away from the school. As he drove towards the central cohort, he shot me little glances. I stayed quiet. When I caught sight of myself in the side mirror, I realized I was flushed. I wanted so much to talk to him, but I couldn't wrap my tongue around a coherent sentence. After a few minutes, Nick spoke.
Did you ever tell your father what happened in the field?
No.
Why?
You told me not to.
Good. That's a start. His hands tightened on the wheel. I'm going to tell you a lot of things you won't understand, Paige. You're not like you were before that day, and you need to know why.
I kept my eyes on the road.
He didn't have to tell me. I'd known I was different well before the poppy field. Even as a child, I'd been sensitive to people. Sometimes I'd felt tremors when they passed me, like my fingers had brushed a live wire. But things had changed since that day. Now I couldn't just sense people. I could hurt them. I could make people bleed, make their heads ache and their eyes blur. I would fall asleep in class, only to wake up with my skin drenched in cold sweat. The nurse knew me better than anyone else at school. Something was emerging from inside me, pushing out into the world. In the end, the world was going to see it.
I can help you control it, he said. I can keep you safe.
He'd kept me safe once before. Can I still trust you? I watched his face, the face I'd never forgotten. Nick looked at me.
Always, he said.
We went to a greasy spoon in Silk Street and sipped coffee. It was the first time I'd ever tried it, and I secretly thought it tasted like mud. We talked for a while about my life. I told him about school, about my father's job, but that wasn't why we were there, and we both knew it.
Paige, he said, you've heard about unnaturalness. I don't want to frighten you, but you're showing signs of it.
My throat closed.
He did work for Cyan.
Don't worry.
He placed his hand over mine. My pulse warmed.
I'm not going to turn you in. I'm going to help you.
How?
I'd like you to come and talk to a friend of mine.
Who is it?
Someone I trust. Someone who's very interested in you.
Is he?
Yes.
So am I.
He squeezed my hand.
You had a daydream earlier. You saw my car.
I stared at him, perplexed.
That's my gift, Paige. I can send pictures. I can make people see things.
My mouth was dry.
I'll see him.
I left a message with my father's secretary, telling him I would be home late. Nick drove me to a small French restaurant in Vauxhall. Waiting for us was a tall, fine-boned man, probably in his late 30s. His eyes were alive with a sort of agitated intelligence. He had candle-white skin and a head full of rich, dark hair, and his lips were pale and petulant. You could have sharpened pencils on his cheekbones. He wore a gold cravat and a black embroidered waistcoat with a pocket watch.
"You must be Paige," he said, in a deep, slightly amused voice. "Jackson Hall."
He offered a bony hand. I took it.
"Hello," I said.
His grip was cold and firm. I sat down. Nick sat beside me. When the waitron came, Jackson Hall ordered no food. Just a glass of Mex, or non-alcoholic wine. Expensive stuff. He had fine tastes.
"I have a proposition for you, Miss Mahoney."
Jackson Hall swilled his Mex.
"Dr. Negord came to speak to me yesterday. He informed me that you can inflict certain medical abnormalities on other people. Is that correct?"
I glanced at Nick.
Go on. He gave me a smile. He's not from Cyan.
Don't insult me.
Jackson took a sip of Mex. Further from the Archon than the cradle from the grave. Not that those two states are all that far apart, but you understand my meaning. I wasn't sure I did. He certainly didn't act like a Cyan official. You mean the nosebleeds? I said. Yes, the nosebleeds. Fascinating. His hands were clasped on the table. Anything else? Headaches. Sometimes migraines. And how do you feel when it happens? Tired. Sick. I see. His eyes roved over my face. They were cool and analytical, and they seemed to see beyond me. How old are you? 16, I said. Almost time for you to leave school. Unless, he added, you were asked to attend the university. Not likely. Excellent. But young people do struggle to find work in the Citadel. His fingers drummed on the table. I'd like to offer you a job for life. I frowned. What kind of job? The sort that pays well. The sort that will protect you. Jackson examined me. Do you have any idea what clairvoyance means? Clairvoyance. The forbidden word. I glanced around the restaurant, but nobody was looking. Or listening, it seemed. Unnaturalness, I said. Jackson smiled thinly. So the Archon calls it. But do you know what the word means, from the French? Clear vision. A kind of extrasensory perception. Knowing things that are hidden. And where are they hidden? I hesitated. In the subconscious? Sometimes, yes. Or sometimes. He blew out the candle in the middle of the table. In the ether. I looked into the smoke, drawn to it. A chill spread through my chest. What's the ether? The infinite. We come from it. We live within it. And when we die, we pass back into it. But not all of us are willing to part ways with the physical world. Jax, Nick said, keeping his voice low. This is meant to be an introduction, not a lecture series. She's 16. I want to know, I pressed. Paige, please. I had to know. His expression softened. He sat back in his seat and sipped his water. Your choice. Jackson. He was looking at us with raised eyebrows, pursed his lips before continuing. The ether is a higher plane of existence, he said. It exists alongside the corporeal plane. Clairvoyants, people like us, have the ability to draw on the ether. I was sitting in a restaurant with two unnaturals. How? I said. Oh, there are an infinite number of ways. I've spent 15 years trying to categorize them. But what does it mean to draw on the ether? Asking questions about clairvoyance gave me a sinful little thrill. It means you can commune with spirits, Nick clarified. The dead. Different voyants can do it in different ways. So the ether is like the afterlife. Purgatory, Jackson said. Afterlife, Nick said. Excuse Dr. Niegold. He's trying to be delicate. Jackson sipped his mix. Unfortunately, death is not delicate. I would like to educate you about what clairvoyance truly is, in preference to science's sadly warped perspective of the condition. It is a miracle, not a perversion. You must understand that, my dear, or they will snuff that lovely glow out. They both fell silent when the waitress brought my salad. I looked back at Jax. Tell me more. Jackson smiled. The ether is the source of which Cyan occasionally deems to speak, he said. The realm of the restless dead. The source which the Bloody King supposedly accessed during seance, causing him to commit 5 ghastly murders and bring an epidemic of clairvoyance upon the world. All utter tosh, of course. The ether is simply the spiritual plane, and clairvoyants are those with the ability to access it. There was no epidemic.
We have always been there. Some of us are good, others are evil. If there is any such thing as evil. But whatever we are not a disease. So Cyan lied.
Yes. Harden yourself to the idea.
Jackson lit a cigar.
Edward might well have been Jack the Ripper, but I highly doubt he was clairvoyant at all. Far too clumsy.
We have no idea why they pinned it all on clairvoyance, Nick said. It's a mystery only the Archon understands.
How does it work?
My skin was prickling and hot.
I could be unnatural. I could be one of them.
Not all spirits go peacefully into the heart of the ether, where we think some kind of final death is found, Jackson said. He was relishing this, I could tell. Instead they linger, roving between the corporeal and spiritual planes. When they're in this state, we call them drifters. They still have personality, and most can be contacted. They only have a certain degree of freedom, and are usually happy to assist voyants.
You're talking about real, dead people, I said. You can just pull their strings and they'll dance.
Correct.
Why would any of them want that?
Because it means they can stay with their loved ones.
He sniffed like he didn't understand the concept.
Or with people they'd like to haunt.
They sacrifice free will in exchange for a kind of immortality.
I took a mouthful of salad and chewed. It was like chewing a wad of wet cotton.
Of course, they don't start off as spirits. Jackson tapped the back of my hand. You have a flesh body. You can walk on the corporeal plane. But you also have a private connection to the ether. We call it the dreamscape. The scenery of the human mind.
Wait, wait. You keep saying we, I said. Who are we exactly?
Clairvoyants?
Yes. It's a very vibrant community. Nick gave me a warm smile, but a very secret one.
You can identify voyants by their aura.
That's how Nick recognized you, Jackson said. My growing interest seemed to animate him.
Everyone has a dreamscape, you see. An illusion of safety. A kind of locus amenus, you understand.
I wasn't sure I did.
Voyants of colored dreamscapes. The rest of black and white ones. They see their dreamscapes when they dream. Amaurotics, consequently, dream in monochrome. Voyants, conversely, dream in color.
Voyants don't dream, my dear girl. Not in the same way that amaurotics do. That idle pleasure is for them alone. But the color of a clairvoyant's dreamscape shines through his or her corporeal form, creating an aura. People of the same voyant type tend to have very similar auras. You'll learn to group them.
Can I see auras?
They exchanged glances. Nick reached up and peeled two filmy lenses from his eyes. Chills ran down my back.
Look at my eyes, Paige.
You didn't need to tell me twice.
I remembered those eyes as clearly as if it had been yesterday. That exquisite gray-green. Those delicate lines radiating through the iris. What I hadn't noticed was a small keyhole-shaped defect in his right pupil. Some voyants have a kind of third eye. He sat back. They can see auras. They can also see drifters. You can be half-sighted, like me, with just one coloboma, or full-sighted, like Jax.
Jackson pulled his eyelids wide open for me. He had the defect in both eyes.
I don't have that, I said.
So I'm clairvoyant, but I don't have a third eye?
Unsightedness is quite common in the higher orders. Your gift doesn't require you to see spirits.
Jackson gave me a pleased look.
You can feel auras and drifters, but you don't perceive them visually.
It's not really a disadvantage, Nick patted my hand.
Your sixth sense will be much more attuned with